sort of thing. When you touch Lerna, not for sex, you don't have the energy, but cuddling for warmth saves calories, and he needs the comfort. It feels good, but in an equally detached way. You feel as though you're floating above yourself, watching him sigh, listening to someone else yawn, like it's happening to someone else. This is what happened to Alabaster, you remember. A detachment from the flesh as it became no longer flesh. You resolved to do a better job of eating at every opportunity. 3 weeks into the desert, as expected, the high road veers off to the west. From there on, Kostrima must descend to the ground and contend with desert terrain up close and personal. It's easier in some ways, because at least the ground isn't likely to crumble away beneath your feet. On the other hand, sand is harder to walk on than asphalt. Everyone slows down. Mashish earns his keep by drawing enough of the moisture out of the topmost layer of sand and ash and icing it a few inches down to firm it up beneath everyone's feet. It exhausts him to do this on a constant basis, though, so he saves it for the worst patches. He tries to teach Temel how to do the same trick, but Temel's an ordinary feral. He can't manage the necessary precision. You could have done it once. You don't let yourself think about this. Scouts sent forth to try to find a better path all come back and report the same thing. Rusting sand, ash, mud everywhere. There is no better path. 3 people got left behind on the high road, unable to walk any further because of sprains or breaks. You don't know them. In theory, they'll catch up once they've recovered. But you can't see how they'll recover with no food or shelter. Here on the ground, it's worse. A half dozen broken ankles, 1 broken leg, 1 wrenched back among the strongbacks pulling the wagons, all in the first day. After a while, Lerna stops going to them unless they ask for his help. Most don't ask. There's nothing he can do, and everyone knows it. On a chilly day, Antrag the potter just sits down and says she doesn't feel like going any further. Yika actually argues with her, which you weren't expecting. Antrag has passed on her skill of pottery to 2 younger, calm members. She's redundant, long past childbearing. It should be an easy headwoman's choice by the rules of old Sansa and the tenets of stone lore. But in the end, Antrag herself has to tell Yika to shut up and walk away. It's a warning sign. "I can't do this anymore," you hear Yika say later, when Antrag has fallen out of sight behind you. She plods forward, her pace steady and ground-eating as usual, but her head is down, hanks of wet ashblow hair obscuring her face. "I can't. It isn't right. It shouldn't be like this. It shouldn't just be. There's more to being Kostrima than being rusting useful for Earth's sake. She used to teach me in creche. She knows stories. I rusting can't." Hjarka leadership Kostrima, who was taught from an early age to kill the few so the many might live, only touches her shoulder and says, "You'll do what you have to do." Yika doesn't say anything for the next few miles. But maybe that's just because there's nothing to say. The vegetables run out first, then the meat. The cash bread Yika tries to ration for as long as she can. But the plain fact is that people can't travel at this speed on nothing. She has to give everyone at least a way for a day. That's not enough, but it's better than nothing. Until there is nothing. And you keep walking anyway. In the absence of all else, people run on hope. On the other side of the desert, Danil tells everyone around a campfire one night, "There's another Imperial road you can pick up. Easy traveling all the way to Renonis. It's a river delta region, too, with good soil, once the breadbasket of the Equatorials. Lots of now-abandoned farms outside of any calm. Danil's army had good foraging there on its way south. If you can get through the desert, there will be food. If you can get through the desert. You know the end to this, don't you? How could you be here listening to this tale if you didn't? But sometimes it is the how of a thing, not just the end game, that matters most. So this is the end game. Of the nearly 1,100 souls who went into the desert, a little over 850 reached the Imperial Road. For a few days after that, the calm effectively dissolves. Desperate people, no longer willing to wait for orderly foraging by the hunters, stagger off to dig through sour soil for half-rotted tubers and bitter grubs and barely chewable woody roots. The land around here is scraggly, treeless, half-desert and half-fertile, long depopulated by the Rennies. Before she loses too many people, Yika orders camp made on an old farm with several barns that have managed to survive the season thus far. The walls, apart from basic framing, haven't fared as well, but then they haven't collapsed either. It's the roofs she wanted, since the rain still falls here on the desert's edge, though it's lighter and intermittent. Nice to sleep dry, at last. 3 days, Yika gives it. During that time, people creep back in ones and twos, some bringing food to share with others too weak to forage. The hunters who bother to return bring fish from one of the river branches that's relatively nearby. One of them finds the thing that saves you. The thing that feels like life after all the death behind you. A farmer's private house cache of cornmeal sealed in clay urns and kept hidden under the floorboards of the ruined house. You have nothing to mix it with, no milk or eggs or dried meat, just the acid water. But food is that which nourishes, Stonelore says. The calm feasts on fried corn mush that night. One urn has cracked and teems with mealy bugs, but no one cares. Extra protein. A lot of people don't come back. It's a season. All things change. At the end of 3 days, Yika declares that anyone still in the camp is Kestrema. Anyone who hasn't returned is now ashed out and calmless. Easier than speculating on how they might have died, or who might have killed them. What's left of the group strikes camp. You head north. Was this too fast? Perhaps tragedies should not be summarized so bluntly. I meant to be merciful, not cruel. That you had to live it is the cruelty. But distant detachment heals. Sometimes. I could have taken you from the desert. You did not have to suffer as they did, and yet they have become part of you, the people of this calm, your friends, your fellows. You needed to see them through. Suffering is your healing, at least for now. Lest you think me inhuman, a stone, I did what I could to help. Some of the beasts that hibernate beneath the sand of the desert are capable of preying on humans. Did you know that? A few woke as you passed, but I kept them away. One of the wagon's wooden axles partially dissolved in the rain and began to sag, though none of you noticed. I transmuted the wood, petrified it, if you prefer to think that way, so that it would last. I am the one who moved the moth-eaten rug in that abandoned farmhouse so that your hunter found the cornmeal. Ontrog, who had not told Yika about the growing pain in her side and chest, or her shortness of breath, did not live long after the calm left her behind. I went back to her on the night that she died, and tuned away what little pain she felt. You've heard the song. Antimony sang it for Alabaster once. I'll sing it for you if... She was not alone at the end. Does any of this comfort you? I hope so. I'm still human. I told you. Your opinion matters to me. Kostrima survives. That is also what matters. You survive. For now, at least. And at last, some while later, you reach the southernmost edge of Renonis' territory. Honor in safety, survival under threat. Necessity is the only law. Tablet 3, Structures, verse 4. 10. Nasun, through the fire. All of this happens in the earth. It is mine to know and to share with you. It is hers to suffer. I'm sorry. Inside the pearlescent vehicle, the walls are inlaid with elegant vining designs wrought of what looks like gold. Nasun isn't sure if the metal is purely decorative or has some sort of purpose. The hard, smooth seats, which are pastel colors and shaped something like the shells of mussels that she ate sometimes at Found Moon, have amazingly soft cushions. They are locked to the floor, Nasun finds, and yet it is possible to turn them from side to side or lean back. She cannot fathom what the chairs are made of. To her greater shock, a voice speaks in the air a moment after they settle in. The voice is female, polite, detached, and somehow reassuring. The language is incomprehensible and not remotely familiar. However, the pronunciation of the syllables is no different from that of Sansmat, and something about the rhythm of the sentences, their order, fits the expectations of Nasun's ear. She suspects that part of the first sentence is a greeting. She thinks a word that keeps being repeated amid a passage that has the air of a command might be a softening word, like please. The rest, however, is wholly foreign. The voice speaks only briefly, then falls silent. Nasun glances at Shafa and is surprised to see him frowning, eyes narrowed in concentration, though some of that is also tension in his jaw and a hint of extra pallor around his lips. The silver is hurting him more, and it must be bad this time. Still, he looks up at her in something like wonder.
I remember this language, he says.
Those weird words? What did she say?
That this, he grimaces, thing, it's called a vehimel. The announcement says it will depart from this city and begin the transit to Core Point in 2 minutes, to arrive in 6 hours. There was something about other vehicles, other routes, return trips to various nodes. I don't remember what that means. And she hopes we will enjoy the ride.
He smiles thinly. Oh. Pleased, Nasun kicks a little in her chair. 6 hours to travel all the way to the other side of the planet? But she shouldn't be amazed by that, maybe, since these are the people who built the obelisks. There seems to be nothing to do but get comfortable. Cautiously, Nasun unslings her runny sack and lets it hang from the back of her chair. This causes her to notice that something like lichen grows all over the floor, though it cannot be natural or accidental. The blooms of it spread out in pretty regular patterns. She stretches down a foot and finds that it is soft, like carpet. Shafa is more restless, pacing around the comfortable confines of the vehimel and touching its golden veins now and again. It's slow, methodical pacing, but even that is unusual for him. So Nasun is restless, too.
I've been here, he murmurs.
What?
She heard him. She's just confused. In this vehimel, perhaps in that very seat. I've been here. I feel it. And that language. I don't remember ever having heard it, and yet...
He bares his teeth suddenly
and thrust his fingers into his hair. Familiarity, but no context, no meaning. Something about this journey is wrong. Something is wrong, and I don't remember what.
Shafa has been damaged for as long as Nasin has known him, but this is the first time he has seemed damaged to her. He's speaking faster, words tumbling over one another. There is an oddness to the way his eyes dart around the vehemal interior that makes Nasin suspect that he's seeing things that aren't there. Trying to conceal her anxiety, she reaches out and pats the shell chair beside her. These are soft enough to sleep in, Shafa. It's too obvious a suggestion, but he turns to gaze at her, and for a moment, the haunted tension of his expression softens.
Always so concerned for me, my little one.
But it stops the restlessness, as she'd hoped, and he comes over to sit. Just as he does, Nasin starts. The woman's voice speaks again. It's asking a question. Shafa frowns and then translates slowly.
I think this is the Vihumul's voice. It speaks to us now, specifically. Not just an announcement.
Nasin shifts, suddenly less comfortable inside the thing.
It talks? It's alive? I'm not certain the distinction between living creature and lifeless object matters to the people who built this place, yet.
He hesitates, then raises his voice to haltingly speak strange words to the air. The voice answers again, repeating something Nasin heard before. She's not sure where some of the words begin or end, but the syllables are the same.
It says that we are approaching the transition point, and it asks if we would like to experience.
He shakes his head, irritable.
To see something. Finding the words in our own tongue is more difficult than understanding what's been said.
Nasin twitches with nerves. She draws her feet up into her chair, irrationally afraid of hurting the creature thing's insides. She isn't sure what she means to ask. Will it hurt to see?
Hurt the Vihumul, she means,
but she cannot help also thinking, hurt us. The voice speaks again, before Shafa has time to translate Nasun's question.
No, it says.
Nasin jumps in pure shock, her orogeny twitching in a way that would have earned her a shout from Essun.
Did you say no?
She blurts, looking around at the Vihumul's walls. Maybe it was a coincidence.
Biomajestic storage surpluses permit.
The voice slips back into the old language, but Nasin is certain she did not imagine hearing those oddly pronounced words of Sansmat.
Processing,
it concludes. Its voice is soothing, but it seems to come from the very walls, and it troubles Nasin that she has nothing to look at, no face to orient on while she's listening to it. How is it even speaking with no mouth, no throat? She imagines the cilia on the outside of the vehicle somehow rubbing together like insects' legs, and her skin crawls. It continues.
Translation?
Something.
Linguistic drift.
That sounded like Sansmat, but she doesn't know what it means. It continues for a few more words, incomprehensible again. Nasin looks at Shafa, who's also frowning in alarm.
How do I answer what it was asking before? She whispers. How do I tell it that I want to see whatever it's talking about?
In answer, though Nasin had not meant to ask this question directly of the Vihumul, the featureless wall in front of them suddenly darkens into round black spots, as if the surface has suddenly sprouted ugly mold. These spread and merge rapidly until half of the wall is nothing but blackness, as if they are looking through a window into the bowels of the city, but outside the Vihumul, there's nothing to see but black.
Then light appears on the bottom edge of this window, which really is a window, she realizes. The entire front end of the vehicle has somehow become transparent. The light, in rectangular panels like the ones that lined the stairway from the surface, brightens and marches forward into the darkness ahead. And by its illumination, Nasun is able to see walls arching around them. Another tunnel, this one only large enough for the vehicle, and curving through dark rocky walls that are surprisingly rough-hewn, given the obelisk builder's penchant for seamless smoothness. The vehicle is moving steadily along this tunnel, though not quickly. Propelled by its cilia, by some other means Nasun cannot fathom, she finds herself simultaneously fascinated and a little bored, if that is possible. It seems impossible that something which goes so slow can get them to the other side of the world in 6 hours. If all of those hours will be like this, riding a smooth white track through a rocky black tunnel, with nothing to occupy them except Shafa's restlessness and a disembodied voice, it will feel much longer. And then the curve of the tunnel straightens out, and up ahead, Nasun sees the hole for the first time. The hole isn't large. There's something about it that is immediately, viscerally impressive, nevertheless. It sits at the center of a vaulted cavern, surrounded by more panel lights, which have been set into the ground. As the vehicle approaches, these turn from white to bright red, in a way that Nasun decides is another signal of warning. Down the hole is a yawning blackness. Instinctively, she cesses, trying to grasp its dimensions, but she cannot. The circumference of the hole, yes, it's only about 20 feet across, perfectly circular. The depth, though. She frowns, uncurls from her chair, concentrates. The sapphire tickles at her mind, inviting use of its power, but she resists this. There are too many things in this place that respond to the silver, to magic, in ways she doesn't understand. And anyway, she's an origin. Sessing the depth of a hole should be easy. But this hole stretches deep, deep, beyond her range. And the vehicle's track runs right up to the hole and over its edge. Which is as it should be, should it not? The goal is to reach Court Point. Still, Nasun cannot help a surge of alarm that is powerful enough to edge along panic. Shafa! He immediately reaches for her hand. She grips it tightly, with no fear of hurting him. His strength, which has only ever been used to protect her, never in threat, is desperately needed reassurance right now.
I have done this before, he says, but he sounds uncertain. I have survived it.
But you don't remember how, she thinks, feeling a kind of terror that she doesn't know the word for. That word is premonition. Then the edge is there, and the vehicle tips forward. Nasun gasps and clutches at the armrests of her chair, but bizarrely there is no vertigo. The vehicle does not speed up. Its movement pauses for a moment, in fact, and Nasun catches a fleeting glimpse of a few of the thing's cilia blurring at the edges of the view, as they somehow adjust the trajectory of the vehicle from forward to down. Something else has adjusted with this change, so that Nasun and Shafa do not fall forward out of their seats. Nasun finds that her back and butt are just as firmly tucked into the chair now as before. Even though this is impossible. And meanwhile, a faint hum within the vehicle, which until now has been too low to be much more than subliminal, abruptly begins to grow louder. Unseen mechanisms reverberate faster in an unmistakable cycling up pattern. As the vehicle completes its tilt, the view fills with darkness again. But this time Nasun knows it is the yawning black of the pit. There's nothing ahead anymore, only down.
launch, says the voice within the vehicle.
Nasun gasps and clutches Shafa's hand harder as she is pressed back into her seat then by motion. It isn't as much momentum as she should be feeling, however, because her very sense tells her that they have just shot forward at a tremendous rate, going much, much faster than even a running horse. Into the dark. At first, the darkness is absolute, though broken periodically by a ring of light that blurs past as they hurtle through the tunnel. Their speed continues to increase. Presently, these rings pass so quickly that they are just flashes. It takes three before Nasun is able to discern what she's seeing and assessing, and then only once she watches a ring as they pass it. Windows. There are windows set into the walls of the tunnel, illuminated by the light. There's living space down here, at least for the first few miles. Then the rings stop, and the tunnel is nothing but dark for a while. Nasun senses impending change an instant before the tunnel suddenly brightens. They can see a new ruddy light that intersperses the rock walls of the tunnel. Ah, yes. They've gone far enough down that some of the rock has melted and glows bright red. This new light paints the vehicle's interior bloody and makes the gold filigree along its walls seem to catch fire. The forward view is indistinct at first, just red amid gray and brown and black, but Nasun understands instinctively what she's seeing. They have entered the mantle, and her fear finally begins to ebb amid fascination. The asthenosphere, she murmurs. Shafa frowns at her, but naming what she sees has eased her fear. Names have power. She bites her lip, then finally lets go of Shafa's hand to rise and approach the forward view. Up close, it's easier to tell that what she's seeing is just an illusion of sorts. Tiny diamonds of color rising on the vehicle's inner skin like a blush to form a mosaic of moving images. How does it work? She can't begin to fathom it. Fascinated, she reaches up. The vehicle's inner skin gives off no heat, though she knows they are already at a level underground where human flesh should burn up in an instant. When she touches the image on the forward view, it ripples ever so slightly around her finger like waves in water. Putting her whole hand on a roil of brown-red color, she cannot help smiling. Just a few feet away on the other side of the vehicle's skin is the burning earth. She's touching the burning earth, thinly removed. She puts her other hand up, presses her cheek against the smooth plates. Here in this strange dead-sieve contraption, she is part of the earth, perhaps more so than any origin before her has ever been. It is her, it is in her, she is in it. When Nasun glances back over her shoulder at Shafa, he's smiling, despite the lines of pain around his eyes. It's different from his usual smile. What? She asks.
The leadership families of humanists believe that origins once ruled the world, he says. That their duty was to keep your kind from ever regaining that much power. That you would be monstrous rulers of the world, doing back to ordinary folk what had been done to you if you ever got the chance. I don't think they were right about any of it. And yet.
He gestures as she stands there illuminated by the fire of the earth.
Look at you, little one. If you are the monster they imagined you to be, you are all so glorious.
Nasun loves him so much. It's why she gives up the illusion of power and goes back to sit beside him. But when she gets close, she sees just how much strain he's under. Your head hurts a lot. His smile fades.
It's bearable.
Troubled, she puts her hands on his shoulders. Dozens of nights of easing his pain have made it easy. But this time, when she sends silver into him,
the white-hot burn of lines between his cells does not fade. In fact, they blaze brighter, so sharply that Shafa tenses and pulls away from her, rising to begin pacing again. He has plastered a smile on his face, more of a rictus as he prowls restlessly back and forth. But Nasun can tell that the smile endorphins are doing nothing. Why did the lines get brighter? Nasun tries to understand this by examining herself. Nothing of her silver is different. It flows in its usual clearly delineated lines. She turns her silver gaze on Shafa and then belatedly notices something stunning. The vehicle is made of silver, and not just fine lines of it. It is surrounded by silver, permeated with it. What she perceives is a wave of the stuff rippling in ribbons around herself and Shafa, starting at the nose of the vehicle and enclosing them behind. This sheath of magic, she understands suddenly, is what's pushing away the heat and pushing back on the pressure and tilting the lines of force within the vehicle so that gravity pulls towards its floor and not toward the center of the earth. The walls are only a framework. Something about their structure makes it easier for the silver to flow and connect and form lattices. The gold filigree helps to stabilize the churn of energies at the front of the vehicle, or so Nasun guesses, since she cannot understand all the ways in which these magic mechanisms work together. It's just too complex. It is like riding inside an obelisk. It's like being carried by the wind. She had no idea the silver could be so amazing. But there is something beyond the miracle of the Vihumul's walls. Something outside the Vihumul. At first, Nasun isn't sure what she's perceiving. More lights? No. She's looking at it all wrong. It's the silver, same as what flows between her own cells. It's a single thread of silver. And yet it is titanic, curling away between a whirl of soft, hot rock and a high-pressure bubble of searing water. A single thread of silver, and it is longer than the tunnel they have traversed so far. She can't find either of its ends. It's wider than the vehicle's circumference and then some. Yet otherwise, it's just as clear and focused as any one of the lines within Nasun herself. The same, just immense. And Nasun understands then. She understands so suddenly and devastatingly that her eyes snap open, and she stumbles backward with the force of the realization, bumping into another chair and nearly falling before she grabs it to hold herself upright. Shafa makes a low, frustrated sound and turns in an attempt to respond to her alarm. But the silver within his body is so bright that when it flares, he doubles over, clutching at his head and groaning. He is in too much pain to fulfill his duty as a guardian, or to act on his concern for her, because the silver in his body has grown to be as bright as that immense thread out in the magma. Magic, Steel called the silver. The stuff underneath orogeny, which is made by things that live, or once lived. This silver, deep within Father Earth, wends between the mountainous fragments of his substance, in exactly the same way that they twine among the cells of a living, breathing thing. And that is because a planet is a living, breathing thing. She knows this now, with the certainty of instinct. All the stories about Father Earth being alive are real. But if the mantle is Father Earth's body, why is his silver getting brighter? No. Oh, no! Shafa, Nasun whispers. He grunts. He has sagged to one knee, gasping shallowly as he clutches at his head. She wants to go to him, comfort him, help him. But she stands where she is, her breath coming too fast from rising panic at what she suddenly knows is coming. She wants to deny it, though. Shafa, please,
that thing in your head, the piece of iron. You called it a core stone, Shafa.
Her voice is fluttery. She can't catch her breath. Fear has nearly closed her throat.
No, no, she did not understand. But now she does, and she has no idea how to stop it. Shafa, where does it come from, that core stone thing in your head?
The Vihamel's voice speaks again with that greeting language, and then it continues, obscene in its detached pleasantry.
A marvel only available.
Something. Root. This Vihamel. Something. Heart. Illuminated. Something.
For your pleasure.
Shafa does not reply, but Nasun can sense the answer to her question now. She can feel it as the paltry thin silver that runs through her own body resonates. But that is a faint resonance from her silver, generated by her own flesh. The silver in Shafa, in all guardians, is generated by the core stone that sits lodged in their Sisapine. She's studied this stone sometimes, to the degree that she is able while Shafa sleeps, and she feeds him magic. It's iron, but like no other iron she's ever sensed. Oddly dense, oddly energetic, though some of that is the magic that it channels into him from somewhere. Oddly alive. And when the whole right side of the Vihamel dissolves to let its passengers glimpse the rarely seen wonder that is the world's unfettered heart, it already blazes before her. A silver sun underground, so bright that she must squint, so heavy that perceiving it hurts her Sisapine, so powerful with magic that it makes the lingering connection of the sapphire feel tremulous and weak. It is the earth's core, the source of the core stones, and before her it is a world in itself, swallowing the viewscreen and growing further still as they hurtle closer. It does not look like rock, Nasun thinks faintly, beneath the panic. Maybe that's just the waver of molten metal and magic all around the Vihamel. But the immensity before her seems to shimmer when she tries to focus on it. There's some solidity to it. As they draw closer, Nasun can detect anomalies dotting the surface of the bright sphere, made tiny by contrast, even as she realizes they are obelisks. Several dozen of them jammed into the heart of the world like needles in a pincushion. But these are nothing. Nothing. And Nasun is nothing. Nothing. Before this. It's a mistake to bring him, Steele had said of Shafa. Panic snaps. Nasun runs to Shafa as he falls to the floor, thrashing. He does not scream, though his mouth is open and his ice-white eyes have gone wide, and his every limb, when she wrestles him onto his back, is muscle stiff. One flailing arm hits her collarbone, flinging her back, and there is a flash of terrible pain. But Nasun barely spares a thought for it before she scrambles back to him. She grabs his arm with both of her own and tries to hold on because he is reaching for his head and his hands are forming claws and his nails are raking at his scalp and face. Shafa, no! She cries. But he cannot hear her. And then the Vihamel goes dark inside. It's still moving, though slower. They've actually passed into the semi-solid stuff of the core, the Vihamel's root skimming its surface. Because, of course, the people who built the obelisks would revel in their ability to casually pierce the planet for entertainment. She can feel the blaze of that silver-churning sun all around her. Behind her, however, the wall window goes suddenly dim. There's something just outside the Vihamel, pressing against its sheath of magic. Slowly, with Shafa writhing in silent agony in her lap, Nasun turns to face the core of the earth. And here, within the sanctum of its heart, the evil earth notices her back. When the earth speaks, it does not do so in words exactly.
This is a thing you know already, but that Nasun only learns in this moment. She senses the meanings, hears the vibrations with the bones of her ears, shudders them out through her skin, feels them pull tears from her eyes. It is like drowning in energy and sensation and emotion. It hurts. Remember, the earth wants to kill her. But remember, too, Nasun wants it just as dead. So it says in microshakes that will eventually stir a tsunami somewhere in the southern hemisphere. Hello, little enemy. This is an approximation, you realize. This is all her young mind can bear. And as Shafa chokes and goes into convulsions, Nasun clutches at his pain-racked form and stares at the wall of rusty darkness. She isn't afraid anymore. Fury has steeled her. She is so very much her mother's daughter. You let him go, she snarls. You let him go right now. The core of the world is metal, molten, and yet crushed into solidity. There is some malleability to it. The surface of the red darkness begins to ripple and change as Nasun watches. Something appears that, for an instant, she cannot parse. A pattern, familiar. A face. It is just a suggestion of a person. Eyes and a mouth, shadow of a nose. But then for just an instant, the eyes are distinct in shape, the lips lined and detailed, a mole appearing beneath the eyes, which open. No one she knows, just a face, where there should be none. And as Nasun stares at this, dawning horror slowly pushes aside her anger. She sees another face, and another, more of them appearing all at once to fill the view. Each is pushed aside as another rises from underneath. Dozens. Hundreds. This one jowled and tired-looking, that one puffy as if from crying, that one open-mouthed and screaming in silence like Shafa. Some look at her pleadingly, mouthing words she wouldn't be able to understand, even if she could hear. All of them ripple, though, with the amusement of a greater presence. He is mine. Not a voice. When the earth speaks, it is not in words. Nevertheless, Nasun presses her lips together and reaches into the silver of Shafa and ruthlessly cuts as many of the tendrils etched into his body as she can, right around the core stone. It doesn't work like it usually does when she uses the silver for surgery. The silver lines in Shafa reestablish themselves almost instantly and throb that much harder when they do. Shafa shudders each time. She's hurting him. She's making it worse. There's no other choice. She wraps her own threads around his core stone to perform the surgery he would not permit her to do a few months before. If it shortens his life, at least he will not suffer for what is left of it. But another ripple of amusement makes the Vihumul shudder, and a flare of silver blazes through Shafa that shrugs off her paltry threads. The surgery fails. The core stone is seated as firmly as ever amid the lobes of his sesapine, like the parasitic thing it is. Nasun shakes her head and looks around for something, anything else that might help. She is distracted momentarily by the boil and shift of faces in the surface of the rusty dark. Who are these people? Why are they here, churning amid the earth's heart? Obligation, the earth returns, in wavelets of heat and crushing pressure. Nasun bares her teeth, struggling against the weight of its contempt. What was stolen or lent must be recompensed. And Nasun cannot help but understand this, too, here within the earth's embrace, with its meaning thrumming through her bones. The silver, magic, comes from life. Those who made the obelisks sought to harness magic, and they succeeded. Oh, how they succeeded. They used it to build wonders beyond imagining. But then they wanted more magic than just what their own lives, or the accumulated eons of life and death on the Earth's surface, could provide. And when they saw how much magic brimmed just beneath that surface, ripe for the taking, it may never have occurred to them that so much magic, so much life, might be an indicator of awareness. The Earth does not speak in words, after all. And perhaps Nosin realizes, having seen entirely too much of the world to still have much of a child's innocence. Perhaps these builders of the great obelisk network were not used to respecting lives different from their own. Not so very different, really, from the people who run the Fulcrums, or Raiders, or her father. So where they should have seen a living being, they saw only another thing to exploit. Where they should have asked or left alone, they raped. For some crimes, there is no fitting justice, only reparation. So for every iota of life siphoned from beneath the Earth's skin, the Earth has dragged a million human remnants into its heart. Bodies rot in soil, after all. And soil sits upon tectonic plates, plates eventually subduct into the fire under the Earth's crust, which convect endlessly through the mantle. And there within itself, the Earth eats everything they were. This is only fair, it reasons, coldly, with an anger that still shudders up from the depths to crack the world's skin and touch off season after season. It is only right. The Earth did not start this cycle of hostilities. It did not steal the moon. It did not burrow into anyone else's skin and snatch bits of its still living flesh to keep as trophies and tools. It did not plot to enslave humans in an unending nightmare. It did not start this war, but it will, Rusting Well, have its due. And oh, does Nosin not understand this? Her hands tighten in Shafa's shirt, trembling as her hatred wavers. Can she not empathize? For the world has taken so much from her. She had a brother once, and a father, and a mother whom she also understands, but wishes she did not, and a home, and dreams. The people of the stillness have long since robbed her of childhood and any hope of a real future. And because of this, she is so angry that she cannot think beyond, this must stop, and I will stop it. So does she not resonate with the evil Earth's wrath herself? She does. Earth eat her. She does. Shafa has gone still in her lap. There is wetness beneath one of her legs. He's urinated on himself. His eyes are still open, and he breathes in shallow gasps. His taut muscles still twitch now and again. Everyone breaks, if torture goes on long enough. The mind bears the unbearable by going elsewhere. Nosin is 10 years old, going on 100, but she has seen enough of the world's evil to know this. Her Shafa has gone away, and might never, ever come back. The Vihamul speeds onward. The view begins to grow bright again as it emerges from the core. Interior lights resume their pleasant glow. Nosin's fingers curl loosely in Shafa's clothes now. She gazes back at the turning mass of the core until the stuff of the sidewall turns opaque again. The forward view lingers, but it too begins to darken. They have entered another tunnel, this one wider than the first, with solid black walls somehow holding back the churning heat of the outer core and mantle. Now Nosin senses that the Vihamul is tilted up, away from the core, headed back toward the surface, but this time on the other side of the planet. Nosin whispers to herself, since Shafa has gone away, "This has to stop. I will stop it."
She closes her eyes, and the lashes stick together, wet. I promise.
She does not know to whom she makes this promise. It does not matter, really.
Not long after, the Vihumel reaches Core Point.
Sil Anagist.
1.
They take Kalenli away in the morning. It is unexpected, at least by us. It also isn't really about us, we realize fairly quickly.
Conductor Galot arrives first.
Although I see several other high-ranking conductors talking in the house above the garden. He does not look displeased as he calls Kalenli outside and speaks to her in a quiet but intent voice. We all get up, vibrating guilt, though we have done nothing wrong. Just spent a night, lying on a hard floor and listening to the strange sound of others' breath and occasional movement. I watch Kalenli, fearing for her, wanting to protect her. Though this is inchoate, I don't know what the danger is. She stands straight and tall like one of them as she speaks to Galot. I assess her tension, like a fault line paused to slip. They are outside of the little garden house, 15 feet away. But I hear Galot's voice rise for a moment.
How much longer do you mean to keep up this foolishness, sleeping in the shed?
Kalenli says calmly, Is there a problem? Galot is the highest ranked of the conductors.
He is also the cruelest. We don't think he means it. It's just that he does not seem to understand that cruelty is possible with us. We are the machine's tuners. We ourselves must be attuned for the good of the project. That this process sometimes causes pain or fear or decommissioning to the briar patch is incidental.
We have wondered if Galot has feelings himself.
He does. I see when he draws back now. Expression all a ripple with hurt, as if Kalenli's words have struck him some sort of blow.
I've been good to you, he says. His voice wavers.
And I'm grateful. Kalenli hasn't shifted the inflection of her voice at all, or a muscle of her face. She looks and sounds for the first time like one of us. And as we so often do, she and he are having a conversation that has nothing to do with the words coming from their mouths. I check. There's nothing in the ambient, save the fading vibrations of their voices. And yet.
Galot stares at her.
Then the hurt and anger fade from his expression, replaced by weariness. He turns away and snaps.
I need you back at the lab today. There are fluctuations in the subgrid again.
Kalenli's face finally moves, her brows drawing down.
I was told I had 3 days.
Geo-arcanity takes precedence over your leisure plans, Kalenli.
He glances toward the little house where I and the others cluster and catches me staring at him. I don't look away, mostly because I'm so fascinated by his anguish that I don't think to. He looks fleetingly embarrassed, then irritated. He says to her, with his usual air of impatience,
Biomagistry can only do distance scans outside of the compound, but they say you're actually detecting some interesting flow clarification in the tuner's network. Whatever you've been doing with them obviously isn't a complete waste of time. I'll take them then to wherever you were planning to go today. Then you can go back to the compound.
She glances around at us, at me, my thinker. It should be an easy enough trip, she says to him while looking at me. They need to see the local engine fragment.
The amethyst?
Galot stares at her.
They live in its shadow. They see it constantly. How does that help?
they haven't seen the socket. They need to fully understand its growth process more than theoretically.
All at once she turns away from me and from him and begins walking toward the big house.
Just show them that, and then you can drop them off at the compound and be done with them.
I understand precisely why Kalinli has spoken in this dismissive tone, and why she hasn't bothered to say farewell before leaving. It's no more than any of us do when we must watch or assess another of our network punished. We pretend not to care.
Tetlewa, your song is toneless, but not silent. From where do you sing?
That shortens the punishment for all, and prevents the conductors from focusing on another in their anger. Understanding this, and feeling nothing as she walks away, are two very different things, however.
Conductor Galot is in a terrible mood after this. He orders us to get our things so we can go.
We have nothing, though some of us need to eliminate waste before we leave, and all of us need food and water.
He lets the ones who need it use Kalinli's small toilet or a pile of leaves out back. I am one of these. It is very strange to squat, but also a profoundly enriching experience. Then tells us to ignore our hunger and thirst and come on. So we do. He walks us very fast, even though our legs are shorter than his and still aching from the day before. We are relieved to see the vehicle he summoned when it comes, so that we can sit and be carried back toward the center of town.
The other conductors ride along with us and Galot.
They keep speaking to him and ignoring us. He answers in terse, one-word replies. They ask him mostly about Kalinli, whether she is always so intransigent, whether he believes this is an unforeseen gen engineering defect, why he even bothers to allow her input on the project when she is, for all intents and purposes, just an obsolete prototype.
"Because she's been right in every suggestion she's made thus far,"
he snaps, after the third such question.
"Which is the very reason we developed the tuners after all. The plutonic engine would need another 70 years of priming before even a test firing could be attempted without them. When a machine's sensors are capable of telling you exactly what's wrong and exactly how to make the whole thing work more efficiently, it's stupid not to pay heed."
That seems to mollify them, so they leave him alone and resume talking, though to each other, not to him.
I am sitting near Conductor Galot.
I notice how the other conductor's disdain actually increases his tension, making anger radiate off his skin, like the residual heat of sunlight from a rock long after night has fallen. There have always been odd dynamics to the conductor's relationships. We've puzzled them out as best we could, while not really understanding. Now, however, thanks to Kalinli's explanation,
I remember that Galot has undesirable ancestry.
We were made this way, but he was simply born with pale skin and ice-white eyes, traits common among the Nies. He isn't Nies. The Nies are gone. There are other races, Selenogistine races with pale skin. The eyes suggest, however, that somewhere in his family's history, distant or he would not have been permitted schooling and medical care and his prestigious current position, someone made children with a Nias person. Or not. The trait could be a random mutation or happenstance of pigment expression. Apparently no one thinks it is, though.
This is why, though Galot works harder and spends more hours at the compound than anyone and is in charge, the other conductors treat him as if he is less than what he is.
If he did not pass on the favor in his dealings with us, I would pity him. As it is, I am afraid of him. I always have been afraid of him.